Hi, everybody. My name is Pat Yeo, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad she didn't tell the story that I told at breakfast this morning. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be invited, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love participating in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's nice to be here with some old friends. And you know, when I got sober, I thought I was 30 years old, and I thought, God, if I stop drinking, you know, and I live for, you know, a reasonably long period of time, that's a long time without a cocktail. I mean, that's going to be awful. And how am I going to fill in the time? I wish I had some of that time I thought I was going to have. You know, my life is so busy and so full, and I feel really blessed. I got drunk the first time when I was 13. I was at a party that night. People were drinking, and I just put my hand out and took a drink. I just wanted to fit in, and the magic happened for me that I assume happened for you, and that is that it changed how I felt. It changed how I felt about me, and it changed how I felt about you. I describe it as I feel like I relaxed for the first time in my life, really relaxed. And I drank that rum and coke, it happened to be, and maybe another one, I don't know. But I got drunk that night, and I could talk to people and make them laugh. I could dance. I don't know if I could dance. I danced and felt like I was dancing. It was magic. But I blacked out, I passed out, and I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know, which was quite a bit more than I meant to do that night. The girls in my crowd were not behaving this way, and I was embarrassed, ashamed, terrified I'd get pregnant. Imagine the bad feelings, you know, that a girl might have under those circumstances, and I had all those bad feelings. But I drank again at the very next possible opportunity without a second thought. I was evidently willing to pay the price to drink from the gate. You know, I certainly didn't think it through at the time, but it's very clear to me today. You know, I was a periodic for a while, mostly because of my age. I didn't have immediate access to alcohol, but I somehow became possessed of a phony ID that said I was 35 or something, and there was actually a liquor store in Newport Beach where I grew up that would sell to minors out the back door on such a ridiculous ID. And, you know, my behavior behind drinking, that first drunk sort of set the tone, if you will, for my drinking career. When I drink, as I like to describe it, I get friendly. And so I developed this reputation in high school for being a friendly girl. And, you know, that's not really how I wanted people to think of me. I wanted to be admired and respected. I meant to grow up and get married and stay married to that same person forever. You know, I meant to live a decent life, but I'm 13, 14, 15 years old, and I kind of sense it's not going to be happening for me. I did get married when I was 18 because he asked. And you know, I read a lot of books, and in books, brides-to-be feel stuff that I was not feeling, but I of course never discussed this with anybody, but I just sort of sensed that I didn't have that gene or something, and he was a perfectly nice person, and he loved me, and so why not, you know? And so with this strong, you know, reason to get married, I walked down the aisle and got married. We were married for 6 months, and I left him. That's a mistake, and I just want to say I don't think you have to count those marriages that are 6 months and under. That's just my personal opinion, and I'll bet there's a lot of people in here who would agree. Yeah. Oh my God, are we having a power outage here? So I left him, and I was 18 years old. I was working at JCPenney Company, and I was working in the credit and layaway department, and it's also where we did gift wrapping, and so some cash crossed that counter. You know, if you were getting your present wrapped, you know, you would just hand me the $3 or the $5, whatever it was. And I don't know, some of that cash just kept finding its way into my pocket, you know, and so had to make amends for that later on. But I'm working there, and I worked in the evening until the store closed at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, whatever it was. And one evening, about 8:30, the phone rang in my department, and I answered it, and this man said, "May I speak to Pat? This is Pat." And he said, "Oh, hi, this is," I don't know what his name was, "I met you last night," and he named a bar. And now I wasn't even old enough to drink in a bar, so I knew it wasn't me. And so I said, "Actually, I think you want the other Pat. She's not, you know, she's off tonight." Excuse me, "She's off tonight. I am not the Pat that you met." And he said, "Well, you sound very nice." And I acknowledged that I was. And so he said, "Well, would you like to go out for a drink after you get off work?" "Sure." So 10 o'clock came, and I went out the back door to where the parking lot for the employees, and now there's like nobody out there except this guy who I have never met in a car, and I get in the car, and now he could see. Now I'm 18, but I look like I'm about 13. You know, I mean, I really looked young for my age, and he could see right away there was no way he was taking me into a bar. And so he said, well, we'll just go pick up a bottle somewhere. And I said, okay, that's great. And so we stop at a liquor store, he buys a bottle, and we go and we park in a orange grove somewhere, and we're drinking and, let's just say, getting to know each other better. And at one point, I hope I never forget this, at one point he had a hand on each of my arms, you know, and he sort of was holding me off like this, and he looked me dead in the eye, and he said, you know, I could kill you right now and nobody would ever know, because nobody knows we ever met. And my blood ran cold, and I did the only thing I know how to do, and that is I reached for that bottle and I took another drink. You know, I don't even remember what happened. I can imagine, but I don't really remember. Obviously, he didn't kill me. But, I'm at the very beginning of my drinking, and this is what's happening to me already. I remember saying to somebody at one point that I thought I was probably a potential alcoholic. I believe today that I was an alcoholic from that very first drink. No question about it. It doesn't really matter. But, you know, that's kind of, you kind of get the idea of how it was going. Here's how I drank. I was working as a secretary. I'm a really good secretary. I never have any trouble getting a job, but I have trouble keeping jobs. I've never been fired, but I've quit every job I've had behind something that happened while drinking. You know, I've quit jobs after office Christmas parties without going back to clean out my desk because I knew I couldn't face them in the light of day after what happened last night. Here's how I drank. I went out with my boss and my coworkers one night, and I was bar hopping around downtown. We were all bar hopping around downtown LA, and I think we were all drunk, but it would be safe to say I was the drunkest, because when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. I know you'll understand when I explain this. Not my fault, really. The stage was like here. We were at this table right in front. There were maybe 8 or 10 of us in our group, and I had excused myself from the table to go to the ladies' room, which was down the hall behind the stage, and I bumped into the owner of the bar in the hallway there, and I have this vague recollection of making some derogatory remarks about the caliber of his entertainment. So he said something along the lines of, if I thought I was such hot stuff, which evidently I thought. So a moment ago, I was sitting at the table there with my boss and my coworkers, dressed kind of like I am dressed now, and moments later, I am on the stage essentially dressed in nothing. And there was that moment when my boss's eye and mine met, when he realized who that was up there. Seriously, if I live to be 120, I'll never forget the look on his face ever. You know, that was another job that I quit without going back to clean out my desk. Now that night gave me ideas. Now, when I woke up the next morning, I couldn't believe, you know, a strip joint is really beyond tacky, but this is when go-go dancing was sort of becoming pop. I don't know if go-go dancing ever was popular, but in my crowd it was. So go-go dancing was becoming sort of a thing, and in my mind's eye, go-go dancing seemed much, much classier than stripping. I am here to tell you it's not, but we tell ourselves what we need to tell ourselves. And so I went and actually got a paid job as a go-go dancer. My first paid job was in a club on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles. I never met anybody in that club who spoke English. I have no idea how I got the job. I moved then uptown. I say uptown because the next place they spoke English. To another job at this place called Nick's. Nick's was on the outskirts of Chinatown and downtown L.A., which is another way of saying it was on the outskirts of Skid Row, because they kind of come together there. And I met the man who was to become my second husband there at Nick's. He was a customer who clearly recognized talent. The kind of clubs I worked in, dancing ability was not necessarily a requirement. So, and I really don't, I'm not much of a dancer. But, and he's like the most inappropriate man in the state of California for me, so of course we moved right in together, and I eventually did get married. We got married in Las Vegas by a judge who was wearing his bedroom slippers. It was just the most romantic thing ever. We had sat in the car and drank a pint of something before we went up there to exchange vows. And now, he drank. I mean, I met him in a bar, But it turned out he didn't drink as much as I did. And my drinking, not my drinking so much as my behavior behind drinking, got to be this sort of big topic of conversation around our house. I'm now a full-blown alcoholic, and I'm now married, but I'm still behaving like I'm single. And you might imagine that caused some problems in the marriage, and we had a lot of serious discussions, let's just say. I was back working as a secretary, and I would call him like at 4 in the afternoon and say, oh, I'm just going to go out with the girls after work for a drink. Now, I've never gone anywhere to have a drink. I've turned down drinks when I've known there was only going to be a drink, because I know by now that once I start drinking, I need to finish it through. But I would call and say that, and then I'd go to the bar, and then I'd call him, you know, 3 or 4 times. Oh, yeah, I'm going to have one more drink, and then I'll be home. Sometimes I'd make it home. Sometimes I wouldn't. Sometimes I'd make it home missing parts of my clothing. You know, things were bad. There was some violence in our home. This is sometimes misunderstood, but this is my story, and so I'm going to say it. I don't think there's ever a valid reason for a man to hit a woman. Let me be real clear on this, but let me also say that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, stopped drinking, and started behaving differently, the violence in my home stopped. So I just like to toss that out there, because I know when I got here, I felt like a real victim. I felt like, you know, I am the way I am because of that husband or because of my stepfather and things that was going on when I was growing up or whatever. You know, it's not my fault. The truth of the matter is, it is my fault. You know, if it's their fault, there's nothing I can do about it. But there is something I can do about it here. I can change my life here, and that's what I've been doing for the last 41 years, you know, just changing my life slowly, slowly, slowly. So we're married, and he was a gambler. He was gone a lot at night, which by now I just kind of preferred. You know, it was when he was there, I felt like I needed to make the drinking look different than what it was. You know, like you mix a drink in the kitchen. Scotch is my drink of choice, although I will and pretty much have drunk just about everything. But, you know, ice and then scotch and then a certain amount of water. And the really hard part is you go back out to the living room and there's a reasonable period of time this drink should last. There's not an alcoholic in this room who knows what that time is, you know. And so when he was not there, it was just easy. I just take that bottle and put it on the table by where I sat. I used a glass. I'm not like a common drunk, but I, you know, just drank. And I would, I'd play those sad records over. For you young people, records were these round things. So I would, you know, I'd play the sad records over and over again, and my personal favorite was Ray Charles, Born to Lose. Oh, I'd play it and cry and feel sorry for myself and cry some more and play it again. And sometimes then I would call people on the phone. If you're a phone caller or if you're an Al-Anon and took the calls, you know that the idea never occurs at 7:30 in the evening. You know, it's always 2 or 3 in the morning and completely inappropriate people. My personal favorite was a boyfriend I had when I was 12. Of course, I have no idea where he might be living today, so I woke up several other people in my quest to locate him, and I'm pretty sure he and his wife were happy to hear from me when I finally did get through, although he never did call me back. My life was awful. Awful. I was working this horrible little job as a clerk in a YMCA. I had peaked in my career when I was about 23. I was working as a legal secretary. I was making really, really good money for somebody that age and, you know, had a really bright future ahead of me in that field. And my last job before I got sober was I was working as a clerk in a YMCA. And my job pretty much was if you were a member of that Y and you came in to pay your dues, I'm the person who wrote you the receipt. And I was barely hanging onto that job by the skin of my teeth. My other little job there was they did this monthly newsletter that they sent out to their 2,000 members or 3,000, whatever, it was a lot of people. And my job was to type it and, you know, proof it. And it was set up like a newspaper with columns and headlines. And the different departments would give me their little stories that they wanted done, and I would write them. And so I'm putting the newsletter out one day, and I'm standing. Now, this really will date me. I'm standing at the mimeograph machine, you know, with the purple ink that you actually kind of can get a little high off of. And I'm cranking these things out, and I've got about 1,000 of them in the thing when I realize that the headline, this woman who had taught the small children swimming class, classes was retiring after many years. And so I had written this article about this Mary was retiring, and the headline that I had typed was, Mary Obrist, Tiny Tit Director, Retires. I'm looking at that, and I think, I cannot send this out to 1,000 members. I can't do this. So I make the correction. I've got this stack of papers that I somehow have to get rid of. You can't just throw those in the trash can by your desk, you know, and you can't really take them all out at once in your purse. So I just remember it as this huge ordeal for about 3 weeks. You know, I'd take like a handful, they were in my bottom drawer under things, and life was hard. It was so hard. I started, I started getting arrested, and, you know, I can't believe this is happening to me, that I'm a nice girl from Newport Beach, and my first arrest was on a Thanksgiving night. I'd been to dinner at my parents' house in Newport, which was about 50 miles away from where I was living with this second husband, and my husband was not invited to, did I mention my parents were a little unhappy about this marriage? They actually never met him. They felt that strongly about it. So I was invited to Thanksgiving dinner, and he was a chef, and he had gone to, he worked at this restaurant in Beverly Hills, and his boss had a party for all his employees at his house in Beverly Hills. So he went to that. I went to my parents. And I got drunk, of course, at my parents' house, because that's what I do. I get drunk wherever I go. And I'm driving home, and I stopped at a bar on Main Street in downtown L.A., which is Skid Row, and is not in a direct line from my parents' home to where I live, but nonetheless, that is the place I decided to stop to buy cigarettes. And, of course, you know you can't just go in a place like that and ask for change and buy cigarettes. It would be rude. And so, long story short, I came out of the bar, and I got arrested for common drunk, and they took me to Sybil Brand, which was the Women's Institute at the time. Susie is an alum of that place, and kind of a scary place. I felt like I was in way over my head, a lot of scary women in there. They told me I could make a phone call, and I remembered that my husband was at this event at his boss's house, so I called there, and his boss's wife answered the phone, and I identified myself and told her I was in jail. Could she have my husband come bail me out? It did not occur to me it would have been nicer to ask to speak directly to him to deliver that delightful message. My second arrest was in Tijuana for obscene dancing, and that's all I'm saying about that. You know, I've told that story for years from the podium, and my husband said to me one time, you know, you probably should mention that there were no animals involved. It never occurred to me that that's what people were thinking. There were no animals involved, okay? I really need to just stop telling that story entirely, I think. I embarrassed myself. Ooh, I need a drink of water. So I think you get the idea. It would be safe to sum this up by saying I was not drinking like a lady. I started drinking, the situations I was finding myself in were just sort of getting scarier and scarier. And I started drinking pretty much at home. And for the last, I don't know how long, I love speakers who say, and then in 1962, I think it was a Tuesday, I don't know, you know, for 2 years or 5 years, maybe 6 years, I drank pretty much at home. In a rocking chair in my living room, making those phone calls and, you know, playing that sad music. And my husband was gone a lot at night, and that was just fine. And I hated him. I wasn't getting along with my parents. I hated that little job I had. There was nothing about my life that was working. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous one night. I was drunk when I called. A real nice man answered the phone at central office and asked me if I was having a problem with alcohol. I said that I was, and I started to cry. And he stayed on the phone with me a long time, talking to me, telling me about himself. He wanted to send some women to my house. I said, oh, no, thank you. I don't think I'm that bad. And he seemed to understand that. And he told me where a meeting was the following night near where I was living. And we hung up. And, of course, I continued to drink until I passed out. I came to the next morning, and I remembered making the phone call. I didn't remember a lot of the conversation, but parts of it, and I found the piece of paper where I'd written the address of the meeting place down. In the light of day, I thought I'd been just a teensy little bit premature about calling AA, but I couldn't get it out of my mind all day, and I heard myself say to my husband that night at the dinner table, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. he said something really loving, like, yeah, whatever. You know, we were not getting along. And I dressed with some care. Women understand this. I always want to be dressed appropriately for, you know, whatever event I'm at. And I've never been to AA, so I have no idea what that appropriate dress might be. And let me just say, 41 years ago, people dressed up a little bit more for AA meetings than they do today. They dressed up more for everything, let's face it. I don't remember why I discarded certain articles of clothing. I just remember there was a pile of clothes. Women, get this. There was a pile of clothes on the bed when I left that I had tried and discarded as not being quite right. I'm assuming in the end I decided to go for comfort, because what I came to you in was rubber thongs on my feet, baggy jeans, and a knit top that all the knit had gone out of. It was very comfortable. That's what I wore to meetings for the first. I had two of them, a red one and a blue one, and I alternate. I was clean. I washed them, and that's what I wore to meetings for my first, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 months, and nobody ever said a word about how I was dressed until one night. I was maybe 2 or 3 months sober, and I was running late that day from work, and I didn't have time to go home and change into my meeting clothes. And so I came to the meeting dressed in what I'd worn to work that day, which was a nice pantsuit in a kind of a soft rose color. And I think 200 people individually said to me that night, "My, you look pretty." And it made me feel pretty, and it made me start thinking about what I, you know, thinking more about how to dress to go to a meeting. But back to that first meeting, it was in the basement of a church. There were, I think, probably 300 people there, and I thought, there's no way I can get out of this car. I saw them all going down those steps, and you know how we are, kissing and hugging and stuff, and obviously you've all known each other your whole lives, and there's no way I can get out of this car, but somehow I did. And I went down those steps, and there was a man standing at the door who put out his hand and said, "Hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And it made me feel welcome. I think it's the single most important thing anybody ever does in a meeting. I went in the room. It was an 8:30 meeting, so of course I got there at 8:28. I didn't drink that day. The guy on the phone said don't drink, so I'm like stark raving sober. I need a drink bad. I'm at 8:30. I'm often already passed out, so I was not feeling well that night. So I shake his hand. I go in the room, and a man appears out of the crowd, Claude, and said, "Are you new?" And I couldn't even imagine how he knew that. And yeah, I was, and he kind of took me under his wing and got me a big book and a seat in the back of the room. And it was a speaker meeting much like this one. And the speaker that night was a man by the name of Norm Alpe. And I heard him. I remember, he talked really fast. For those of you who didn't know him, we used to say he could give a two-hour talk in 45 minutes flat, you know. And I'm sitting in the back of the room, and I realized I was leaning forward in my chair so I wouldn't miss anything that he was saying. And I became aware of that, and I thought, wow, I'm really, like, in the room, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? And he talked about, we actually drank in one of the same places many years apart. He was a much older man than I, but, you know, I identified is what happened. I identified with him. I believed that he drank the way I drank. I believed that he was sober. I believed that he was this happy, joyous guy. I mean, I could feel it way in the back of the room. Now, if you had pinned me down that night, I would have said, I don't know, maybe if I figure out what it is y'all are doing here, I can stay sober, but I'll never feel the way that guy feels. You can't get from here to there. You just can't. But, of course, what I got that night was hope, and it kept me coming back. I drank a couple more times that week. I got phone numbers at that first meeting, but, of course, I didn't call you. I don't know you. It's me, isn't it? Hello? Oh. Well, now I don't know where I was. So I had my first drink when I was 13. What was I talking about?
You had been listening to Norm.
Oh, Norm, yeah, okay. So I go to the second meeting, and I raise my hand for being under a week of sobriety, and it's good you're paying attention. That's. And I raise my hand again. I got some more phone numbers, and one of these ladies suggested I might actually want to call one of you. I don't know how she knew I hadn't done that, but so I called her. I was drunk when I called her a couple of days later, and she said, "You might want to get a sponsor. You're not doing too keen on your own." And most of us have found that sponsors are pretty helpful. So I didn't know what a sponsor was. Honestly, if I'd known, I might not have asked. Because I come from a home group that really believes in strong sponsorship. But I said, "Oh, okay, well, you'd be my sponsor?" Yeah. So she said, "Meet me tomorrow night, and we'll talk about it. Bring your big book." And so I did that. And that was August 28th, 1975, and my life began that night. The first thing she did And she took the meeting directory that lists all the meetings for the area, and she circled a meeting for every night of the week. She said, on Monday you'll go here and Tuesday there. And I said, oh, no. I'm a married woman. My husband's not happy that I'm at this meeting tonight. There's no way I can go every night. And she said, well, maybe you can do it with less, but if you want me to be your sponsor, this is what I would expect you to do. She said something along the lines of, if you want me to be your sponsor, I assume it's because you want what I have. And if you want what I have, I only know one way to get it, and that's to do what I do. And this is what I do. My life hung in the balance. I wasn't clapping that night, believe me. My life hung in the balance in that conversation. It is, when I think back on it, it's amazing to me that I agreed to do what she was asking me to do. If you're new, this is important. I didn't agree happily, and I definitely didn't do it happily, but I did it. And that's why I'm standing here 41 years later, you know. I started going to meetings every night, and I was right. He didn't like it. He thought that I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to meet men. Now, I'd been cheating on him all the years we'd been married. I had noticed that there were men in AA, and I was not opposed to the idea of getting to know some of you gentlemen better. But none of the men in AA seemed to be interested in me, which hurt my feelings quite a bit. And it also really made me mad that my husband was accusing me of something I was not actually doing right at that minute, you know? So I felt really, really sorry for myself. I cried all the time. As Susie will verify this, I cried at every meeting I went to. My sponsor told me I had to get to every meeting 1 hour early, not 55 minutes early, 1 hour early. And I had early commitments like cookies, chairs, coffee, things, you know, that you do before the meeting. And I was to get there 60 minutes early and do my commitment and then circulate throughout the room and shake hands with other people as they arrive, ask them how they are as though I care, and get 3 phone numbers of women that I don't already have, and then the next day following the meeting, in addition to calling my sponsor, call these 3 women. Well, I'm having a hard enough time calling her. I can't even imagine calling 3 random women whose numbers I just picked. You know, I was afraid when I called you that you weren't going to know who I was, and it was going to be this big, no, the one with the glasses. No, not that one with the glasses. You know, it was making me crazy. So I would dial your number. I'd be literally drenched in sweat thinking about making these calls. I'd dial your number. You'd answer. A giant inhale, and in one long exhale, I'd say something like, hi, my name is Pat. I have long brown hair and glasses. I met you at the meeting last night. I'm new. My sponsor told me I had to call 3 people every day, and you're one of them. So how are you anyway? Now, I don't know if anybody even understood a word I said, but they all seemed to understand that I was new, and they all were kind to me. Everyone was kind to me. My favorite ever was Marianne Kay, who later became a dear friend, and I believe it started with this phone call, because she actually made me laugh during this phone call, and I was not left. Boy, that was, the timing is great. A phone is ringing. She made me laugh, and I was not laughing much in those days. You know, I'd get dressed to go to the meeting. My husband and I would have the fight, you know, before I left the house, and I'd be driving to the meeting sobbing hysterically in the car because of the fight, and I would think, it's not worth it. If this is sobriety, you can have it. I'll go to your stupid meeting tonight because I'm already out of the house tonight, but this is the last one I'm going to. It's too hard. And I'd get to the meeting, and I'd, you know, slam the cookies around in the kitchen or whatever my little job was, and then I'd work the room, and, you know, and by the time the meeting eventually would start, I'd get a little relief. I went to a lot of speaker meetings, and so nothing was going to be expected of me, and I could hear what the speaker was saying, and, you know, I always felt just a little bit better on the way home, and I just kept coming back. And one night, I think I was about 3 months sober, maybe 4, I learned the most important thing I've learned right up to this minute. I was working the room, you know, hi, how are you? And you ask me how I am, and I tell you, you know, I mean, I'm in great detail, sobbing dramatically the whole time. And this guy, Larry G., asked me how I was, and I started, and he cut me off. He said, I don't want to listen to that. Why don't you go talk to a newcomer? Perhaps you'd feel better. And he pointed to a girl in the back of the room. He said, that girl in the red dress is at her very first meeting. Why don't you just march over and say hello? I distinctly, like it just happened, I distinctly remember thinking that I did not care if the girl in the red dress lived or died. I wish Larry would die. But I knew if I did not go talk to that girl, Larry was going to tell my sponsor. So whatever your motivation is. So I walked over to this girl, introduced myself, and the girl who had 12-stepped her, who I knew, said, oh, Pat, I'm so happy to see you. This is this girl's first meeting. She had this big fight with her husband about coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been waiting for you because I knew you're just the exact right person to talk to her. No. No. I think I'm possibly the worst person in the room to talk to her. I fight with my husband every night about going to a meeting. I have nothing of value to share here. I kind of overlooked that I was sober. That's kind of valuable, but I just My whole life was about, my life is so sad, poor me, you know. But I'm standing in front of this girl at her first meeting, and I think, I need to say something positive here. And so I opened up my mouth, and I heard myself say, keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time. Yeah, now I've just lied to a newcomer. You know. Seriously. But something, I turned and walked, I wouldn't have talked to this girl more than 20 seconds. I was completely incapable of it. But I turned, there was a center aisle like this. I was walking back down the aisle, and I stopped, literally stopped dead in my tracks. And I realized it was the first time in that hour period of time, from the time I hit the door of the meeting hall until the meeting actually starts, that I was there and I wasn't crying. And the reason I wasn't crying is for this brief 20 seconds or whatever it was, I thought about somebody else besides myself. It turns out when I'm thinking about you, I'm not thinking about me at the same time. And anytime I'm not thinking about me, I'm having a better day. And so are you, you know, if you're around me. you know, I'd like to tell you from that moment to this, I've happily worked with others, but that would be a lie. But it worked then, it works now. You know, it always works. You know, I just kept coming back, and my first sponsor drank when I was a year and a half sober, and I got a new sponsor right away. This woman was sober a long time, and the first thing she said to me was, you know, I've watched you whine and complain about your... Clearly the problems in this marriage are his fault. I mean, I'm working this spiritual program now, you know? It can't be me. Wasn't exactly working it at home. Let me just say, before I start talking about this... So my sponsor, you know, I'm coming to these meetings. My husband's accusing me of cheating all the time. I'm not. And then I'm 10 months sober, and I meet a guy in a meeting who looks real good to me. Actually, I'd met a bunch, but this one looked back. I got to tell the truth, you know. I was 10 months sober. He was about 10 minutes sober. I saw him when he came in the room the first time, and he had a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head. Oh, my God, my heart started to pound. I leapt across a couple of chairs to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed, you know. And so I go over to my sponsor, and she said, let's not forget, Pat, that you're a married woman. I said, yeah, but I am so unhappy. And she said, nonetheless, you're married, and as long as you're married, I expect you to act married. I said, you know, I don't actually see this as a problem. I'll get divorced. And she said, no. We in Alcoholics Anonymous don't think it's a good idea to make major moves in our first year of sobriety. You just stay married and act married. Well, I was obsessed with this man. Why would God get him sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? You know? Seriously. So we began. I refer to this now as the death dance. It's if you've been around a few months, you've either done this or you've seen it. It starts with the deep, meaningful glances across the room, and then we're kind of brushing up against each other in the coffee line. And then he's walking me to my car after the meeting, and then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting. And it's a little complicated to get together. I'm a married woman. Obviously, we're not going to my place. He's a newcomer. He doesn't have a place. But we're pretty resourceful people. We can make anything happen and almost convince ourselves it's God's will. That part's a little harder, but I was working at the time at this record company in Hollywood, and he was very conveniently working in Hollywood as well at a porn bookstore. You cannot make this stuff up. You just can't. So I arranged this long lunch hour at work one day for somebody to cover for me, and he didn't have a car either, so I pick him up at the bookstore, and we went to a motel, and let's just say got to know each other better. And I dropped him off at the bookstore later that afternoon, and it occurred to me in the car that I was 10 months sober, and I was living exactly the way I'd always lived. I'd been sitting in meetings for 10 months hearing you say pretty much every night that I was going to have to change everything about the way I was living my life, or I was probably going to drink. And I knew that I was in a lot of trouble. I'll tell you, in 41 years of sobriety, that day is the closest I've been to picking up a drink, for sure. I was terrified to tell my sponsor what I had done because she had been quite clear in her direction. But I don't want to drink, you know. And so I told her that night, you know, what had happened. And she said, you know, Pat, I don't think you're a woman who can cheat on her husband and stay sober. And you're lucky you didn't have to pick up a drink today, you know, to prove that. She said, you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to. Okay, I don't want to. I never wanted to live that way, drunk or sober. I never felt good about living that way. I don't see how Alcoholics Anonymous is going to help me. I don't get any of this. I don't get any of it. Here, she gave me a very specific direction, and here's what I did. A day at a time, I stayed away from that guy. That's it. You wanted more, huh? I know I did. I wanted, like, deep, meaningful, I don't know, whatever. I said to her, shouldn't I explain to him? And she said, oh, no, no, no. I think he'll get the idea. And I heard for the first time that line that is read in every single meeting I go to, half measures avail us nothing. And I knew for me, this was going to be the big make it or break it point, you know, that if I was to stay sober, I was going to have to change this behavior because this was the big one for me. And so I did it 100% her way because I don't want to drink, you know. Now, the obsession passed, of course, because obsessions always pass. But the really good news, and the part I didn't even imagine at the time, is I don't live that way anymore. Who knew? Who knew that you could really change your life, you know? Another thing I like to say about that incident is, I think I mentioned that I had somebody at work cover for me that day when I went to pick him up at the bookstore. That was my friend at work, and she knew where I was going and what I was doing. In fact, we talked about it after I got back to the office. You know how we do. And a few months after that, maybe six, I don't know, sometime after that, I left that job, got a better job. But I stayed in touch with that woman. We would have lunch occasionally. And I heard through a third mutual friend that this woman's husband had developed a bad drinking problem, and she had taken him off to some church in the hopes that his drinking problem would be addressed. And I remember thinking when I heard that, why wouldn't she go to Al-Anon or, you know, suggest that he go to AA? I told her a lot about AA. What I showed her about AA is that it's a place where people cheat on their spouses. I don't imagine she would be too keen to take her husband to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it really made me, for the first time, think about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a program of attraction, and I did not make it an attractive place for that family to go. I don't know if he ever got sober or not. I hope he did, but if he did, it's in spite of me. You know, it's made me really stop and think, you know, if people out there are going to know that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have an obligation to behave in a way that would make it an attractive place for them to go or to send somebody they love. Anyway, enough of my little traditions lecture there. So my first sponsor drank when I'm a year and a half sober, and she said, you know, I've watched you whine and complain about your husband, and I don't want to hear it. I want you to pretend like you're a kind and loving wife. Just act as if. She gave me very specific, she said, I don't know what's going to happen. You might have to walk away from this marriage at some point, but you owe a lot of amends to this guy. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is very clear on these difficult amends. It says right in the step, you can't make direct amends when to do so might injure that person or others. That means, Pat, you cannot go home and confess infidelities that he may not know about. That is not an amend. She said, making amends is making it right, making, you know, repairing the damage. She said, I want you a day at a time to pretend like you're a kind and loving wife, and then if you do have to walk away down the road, maybe you can do it without guilt. Maybe you will have made some daily living amends to him. And so I became reluctantly willing to try that. She gave me very specific directions. I started watching other couples in AA, how they treated each other. We have both good examples and bad examples here, but I tried to take the good stuff home and practice it in my home. It always sounds really fast when I'm talking about it from a podium, but time went by months. I don't know how long, really. And one night I was on my knees thanking God for my sobriety, and I realized I was pretty comfortable in that house with that husband, and it hadn't happened that day. It had already this is the biggest problem in my life, and it went away, and I didn't even notice it. I remember I got back down on my knees, and I thought, well, it must have been yesterday. No, I don't know. It already happened. I got back down on my knees, and I remember I thanked God for, I wasn't even sure what I was feeling, but I just said, thank you, and I guess if you mean for me to stay married to this man, I could do that and stay sober and have a good life, thank you. Not long after that, we found out that he had cancer, and my first reaction was, I wish this would have happened when I hated him, because it's all about me, that's who I am. I'm very, very, very glad that it did not happen when I hated him. He was sick for a year and a half, and he did die. I used to say it was the hardest year and a half of my life. That's no longer true, but it was the hardest year and a half up to that point. And he died, and a couple hundred people, I think, took the afternoon off from work to be at his funeral. They did not know him, but of course they knew me. And I realized sitting in that funeral, what my sponsor had promised me had happened. I felt obviously sad, but I felt right about my part in our relationship. I knew that I had made my amends to him. I had no regrets about oh, if only I had just done this little more thing or said, or, you know, it was all, I knew that I was clean, and I was so, so grateful that I had stayed when all of my best judgment said, just get out. Well, this is how I think. Get out while you're young and have your looks. You know, I'm a little shallow. I can't help it. Anyway, I remember thinking that day, this good feeling that I'm having of knowing that I've, you know, 100% made those amends, that's the payoff for doing the work, you know. Here's the thing, though. That's not even close to the payoff. Not even close. After he died, I started dating Vince, who many of you know, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who I met in AA. He was my friend before we ever had a date. That's something new for me. We started dating, and we fell in love and got married, and we were married for 27 years. We had a fabulous life together, and it would not have been possible had I not learned the tools there with my former husband. You see what I'm saying? God's vision for me is much, much greater than anything I can possibly see for myself. Vince died a number of years ago, and my heart broke. That was the hardest 2 years of my life. It was terrible. I barely can remember it. Here's a good reason to have a home group if you're new. You know, I was in the middle of a strong home group, and they just swept me along. You know, people picked me up and took me to the meeting, whether I wanted to go or not. Mostly I didn't want to, but it didn't matter. You know, people surrounded me and walked, you know what I'm trying to say. I can't get my mouth around that sentence for some reason. It was amazing. You know, it was really amazing. Shortly after he died, my mother became ill. She had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and she had been in remission for a long time, but it came back big time, and she had to go to treatment 5 days a week in Pomona, which was like an hour's drive away from where we lived. And so I'm driving her to, I'm, you know, like filled with grief, and I'm driving her to treatment every day, and I'm trying to work, and, you know, I was a mess. My mother was of one political persuasion, and my husband and I were of the other. And my mother was a very wise mother-in-law, and she never, ever, ever, ever discussed politics in our home. She just didn't, you know. And I knew how we knew how all of us felt. We just didn't discuss politics. So now we're driving to Pomona in the car an hour every day, and she starts talking politics. And I got, after a few days, it was really annoying me, but I finally got the fact that she's trying to change my mind. Now that Vince is dead, she thinks she can influence me, and that he's no longer there to influence me. And it really made me mad, and I'm driving, and I'm kind of working a steam up in my head. And then I realized, you know, I've been making living amends to my mother at that point. I don't know, I was 36 years sober or something, and no, whatever it was, 30-some years sober, and I've been making daily living amends to my mother all those years. This is the final push, so to speak. She's old. She's going to die soon, you know, obviously. I don't get to argue with her about politics or anything. If I'm going to really 100% make amends to my mother, my whole job here is to love her until the day she is gone. So we're driving to Pomona, and she's talking politics, and I'm saying things like, gosh, Mom, I never thought of it that way before. Or the good old Al-Anon one, gee, you could be right. Honestly, the veins would stick out on my neck. You know, like, I can't do this. We'd get out to the hospital, and I'd get her settled in her treatment chair, and I'd say, I'm just going to step out in the courtyard and call my office and see if there's anything I need to, you know, be doing. And I'd step out in the courtyard, and I'd burst into tears just from the strain of not saying anything. And then I'd call a friend on the program, and they'd make me laugh, and, you know, my mother died, I think I said, a few months after my husband died, and I'm pretty sure she thinks that she changed, she believes that she had changed my mind, but and that somehow that warms my heart, you know. I'm glad that I didn't argue with her about any of that, you know. She didn't need that. I retired from my job a few years ago, and I guess 5 years ago, and I moved out to Palm Desert, and you know, I wasn't sure what it was going to be like retired. You know, Vince and I had all these plans and for retirement, and now I was doing it alone, and I didn't, you know, I was scared. I didn't know what it was going to be like, you know. And I was also scared about AA. I'd been in the same big, active home group of Alcoholics Anonymous for 36 years at that time, and that's real scary to leave. But I knew, excuse me, before I moved, I had scoped out meetings in where I live now, And I knew three meetings for sure that were going to be regular meetings of mine, and they are. They became regular meetings the day I moved there, and they remain regular meetings to this day, because I knew for me that that was really, really important. It would be really easy to not go to a meeting because I just don't feel like it tonight. You know, I'll go tomorrow night. I don't have that option. I have my regular meetings. Anyway, so I'll just tell one more story, and then I'll sit down. Or not. You never know. I love when a speaker says that, and then there's five more stories. I really will try to keep it to one. When I moved down there, I started. I'm kind of a couch potato. I've never done much exercise, but I started walking a little bit because I'm getting older, and it's probably a good thing to do, you know, health wise. And so I'm taking these little walks and in the neighborhood. And then my friend Linda, who's a big major backpacker, said to me, "Have you ever heard of the Camino de Santiago?" And I said, "No, I have not." And she said, "Go home and Google it, and call me and tell me what you think." So I went home and Googled it, and I called her, and I said, "I want to do this." For those of you who are not familiar, the Camino de Santiago is a spiritual pilgrimage in Spain. You actually start in southern France. You cross the Pyrenees. This is walking, hiking. You cross the Pyrenees Mountains, and then you walk all across northern Spain. It's a 500-mile hike. And you walk, of course, at your own pace, but we had planned to do it like 15 to 17 or 18 miles a day. Remember I said I'm a couch potato and, you know, I'm walking a little mile thing in the neighborhood. And so I say to Linda, "Yes, I totally want to do this." And she said, "You know, you're really going to have to train hard." I said, I know, I want to do it." So she said, "Okay, I'll train you." Okay, great. So we go out for our first day of training. We go out to this, I think it was a 2-mile trail, relatively flat, little tiny bit of uphill, but nothing really. And In my defense, we do live in the desert, I just have to say. But so we do this 2 miles. We're like from here to maybe the back of the room. I can see our car, but I can't get there. I literally can't. There's this big rock, and I sit on the rock. I'm all hunched over on this rock. I've drunk all my water, all her water, you know, and I'm whimpering on this rock. I also should say she's a great photographer, and she memorialized this moment of me on the rock. I actually still have that picture on my refrigerator. I love looking at it. She finally manages to drag me off the rock and back to the car. So we're driving back to, you know, she's taking me home. And I said, "So you're probably thinking you've picked the wrong person to do this trip." But she said, "No, you'll be great." She said, "It's just your first day of training." We had a year to train. She said, "You'll be great." She told me much later that she thought, "Oh, Christ, what have I done? You know, I'm never going to be able to do this." Well, I trained. I can't even believe it when I talk about it that I did this. I trained hard. And it's like 2.5 years ago now. We went to Spain. Actually, we went to France. We start in France. And we started. And we hiked we crossed the Pyrenees Mountains the first couple of days. And the third day, we're hiking. And we'd gone about, I don't know, maybe 14 miles. And we stopped to rest and have a little something to eat and drink. And we got back up, and we started walking again, and I said to her, she was hiking a little bit ahead of me, and I said to her, "You know, I feel as good this moment as I have ever, I can hardly talk about this, as I've ever felt in my entire life. I cannot believe that I am doing this. I feel so good." And about 5 minutes later, I fell. Yeah. Landed on my face, and make a long story short, the trip was over. And so I came home, and in an odd series of circumstances, she actually had to come home as well. But anyway, so I came home, and all my friends were like, you know, the thing about this hike is, and I've read a lot of people's books and blogs about it, is you do this hike, and you get to the cathedral in Santiago, and everybody has this sort of spiritual experience. And I wanted my spiritual experience, you know. So I get home, and everybody, my friends, are all like, "Oh, I'm so sorry you didn't get your spiritual experience." Yes, I did. Yeah, I did. I got it about 5 minutes before that fall, you know. It turns out, who knew? You can't really plan when you're going to have a spiritual experience, you know. I hadn't really thought that through, you know, but that's God's decision, and so I had mine. If you get nothing else out of this talk other than the fact that I love Alcoholics Anonymous and I love living my life today, I hope you hear that. You know, I was a hopeless, helpless, drunken mess of a woman, and today I live free and joyous and happy, and I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.